Okay, Rabosai, if you could, we started the 10th parak, Agozel Machil, which begins on Daf Kuf Yud Aleph on the Beis. Oh, Shalom Aleichem, how are you? But we're going to start on Daf Kuf Yud Beis Amid Aleph. Kuf Yud Beis Amid Aleph. Okay? And if you count down from the top of the page, then it should be approximately, I would say, 10 lines or so down from the top of the page. The first word in the line is Rami. And we're going to start with Tana Rabbanan at the end of that line. Hagozel umachil esbonov pturim milashalit. If the stolen object, or we call them stolen goods, were foodstuff, and the Gazlan fed his own children this food that he stole, and the food was consumed by the children. Normally we say that when the object which was stolen was destroyed, then the Gazlan has to pay what's called damim, he has to pay its value. But in this case, the Brice establishes that we cannot impose a chiyuv damim on the banim, on the children. They did not steal. And if they did not steal, they don't have a chiyuv tashlumin. So let's just go over the basics. Once again, we spoke about this last time, that the Torah says, v'heishiv esak zela sher gozel, and that divides into two different tributaries, if you will. The primary chiyuv is to return the object that was stolen. If the object is stolen, is no longer, then the Cheheshev is like Zeli refers to its domin. Okay, not for Torah's mitzvah, but as a Chiv Mammon. As a Chiv mitzvah is only on the object itself. Once the object is gone, the Chiv mitzvah is gone. But as far as a Chiv domin is concerned, to pay its value so that we compensate for the loss of the Nigzal, that applies even if the object was destroyed. But the Gemara makes a phenomenal and fundamental distinction between the two Chiyuv HaShava. The first Chiyuv HaShava applies universally to anyone. Anyone who comes in contact with this object would be responsible to return it to its proper owner. And from that perspective, the Banim, no less than their father, would be obligated in HaShava. But the Mishnah, this Brisa that we're studying now, which exempts the children from a Chiyuv HaShava, is addressing a case where the object was consumed. It no longer exists in the world. And that drops down to the next Chiyuv HaShava, which is a Chiyuv Damim. And that Chiyuv Damim is fundamentally different than the Chiyuv HaShava on the Be'en, on the actual object itself. And instead of a chiyuv which is inherent in the object, because the object is no longer there, becomes a chiyuv on the gavra, so to speak, on the person, to pay up and compensate the nigzal. But that person has to be whom? The gazlan himself. No one other than the gazlan picks up a chiyuv damim. So as long, again, I'm just repeating, that the object is intact, it's and everyone shares the Chiyuv HaShofa. And if the object now was transferred over to the children, they have to return the object. But if the object is no longer Be'en, it's been destroyed, as in the case of foodstuff that was eaten, now the Chiyuv HaShofa translates itself to a Chiyuv Damim. The Chiyuv Damim is imposed by the Torah on one person and one person only. And who's that? The Gazlan. Oh, now we get to the next case in the Braisa, and that's going to l'chora contradict what I just said. So if you think I'm confusing you, you're probably right. It's all part of a plan. No, I'm just joking. Anyway, he niach lifnehem. Now here's the case where the object is still be'en, meaning the gazlan dies, and the yarshim, his children, inherit him, and they're holding on to the stolen object. Now, in that case, as we said at the outset, everyone is obligated in Hashav. But yet, the Braisa says it depends. Are these children responsible for Hashav, or are they not responsible? It depends. Are they Gdolim or Ktanim? Now, here we have to say a few words about what's called a Tvil Abezdin. In order to be Toveah, in order to sue someone in a Jewish court, that person has to be a gadol, which means he has to be bar mitzvah. If he's younger than bar mitzvah, he's a katan, then This is what's called in the language of the Mishnah, we'll see it later on, Pegiyasan Ra. Pegiyasan Ra means that although any mazik is going to be liable for compensation and he can be sued in a court of law, but Medvar Amun, that only applies if he's a gadol, because I can sue him in a court of law. And Pegiyasan Ra means that you got to be very careful with children, because if they damage, you really have no recourse whatsoever to retrieve your loss. There's no chiyuv compensation here on the part of the ketanim. And therefore, the Brisa says the following: Hineach lifneihem gdolim chayovim l'shalem. If these children are mature, they're not minors, therefore they can be sued in a court of law, and they have to return the object. Now, again, we have to assume now that this is before Yeush, because the Gemara earlier maintains, which is a very controversial issue, but according to one school of thought, a gazlan is kona b'yeush. So let's assume that there was no yeush over here. If there was no yeush, then the nigzal still maintains his ownership over the stolen goods, and they have to be returned. So in the case where the child is a gadol, he has to return the object to its rightful owner, irrelevant to the fact that he was not responsible for or guilty of the maisa gzeila. However, ktanim, if the children that inherited this stolen object, which is still intact, are less than bar mitzvah, then pturim milashalim. They don't have the chiyuv of hashava. And this seems to be antithetical to everything that we've been saying, because we said that the chiyuv hashava, in the case when the object, the stolen good, is still intact, is inherent in the object. So why shouldn't the children be responsible? The answer is the children are responsible. We just can't, is a technicality here. What's the blockage? We cannot bring them into a bezdin. Now what happens later on when this child becomes mature enough, he becomes a gadol, from that point and on, the katan is no longer a katan, he's a gadol, he'll have to return the object. So basically what the Braisa is addressing here is what I call a temporary situation. At this point in history, when the child is a katan, the nigzal has no recourse to retrieve his object.
But can't people have all sorts of halachic chiyuvim without being taken to Beit Din?
Right, but here you have no possibility of getting him into Beit Din. You know what I'm saying? In other cases, you know, he's avoiding the Beit Din because he doesn't want to be sued, but, you know, you might hire a couple of underlong, you know, thugs and get him into Beis Din. But in the case of a katan, halachically, Beis Din will not put the katan on trial. So there's no situation in which a katan is called a nitba, and therefore, as a result, the gazlan has no recourse at this point to get his thing back. It's a little bit similar. Maybe we can get a chair. You want to sit down?
No, I can't stay.
Oh, you can't sit. Oh, you can't stay. Okay, I thought you said you can't sit. I'm sorry. Okay, very good. So wait a minute. So let me just add one point. We have a similar case in Yibum, which means that if, unfortunately, a man dies, a married man, and he leaves no children, his wife falls for Yibum. Now, if he has a brother who is called a Yavam, and that brother is a Katan, that Katan can't do Yibum, which means that as a result of the law of Zikas Yibum, his widow is stuck, and she can't get out of this marriage relationship. However, that's only, again, a temporary situation. That situation can last for 13 years if it's a newborn brother. And there's no way that anyone in the world can change that. I don't even listen to all this shtuyot that they're out there in the thing. This is a halachic tragedy. Those who believe that halacha is all just a bowl of cherries, that's what we used to teach the kids in NCSY, that's not true. Halacha could be very harsh and demanding. Here too, the halacha is somewhat demanding and telling the nigzal that he has no recourse in Beis Din to retrieve his stolen goods because it is now in the possession of ketanim and you can't possibly sue the ketanim. Wait until the katan becomes a gadol. If you're lucky, in the case of food stuff, you're going to have a very good freezer. But, you know, in the case of an object, let's say a table or a chair, hopefully the table or chair will still be in existence when the child reaches his bar mitzvah. you know, it might pay for the nigzal to be invited, you know, to even if he's not invited, but to show up at the bar mitzvah, because immediately after the bar mitzvah, he'll sue him in a court of law. The Gemara tells us about Rav Ashi that he damaged someone's property when he was a katan. And Raphram, who was one of the older generation, forced Rav Ashi to pay damages when Rav Ashi became a gadol for the hezek that he perpetrated when he was a katan. And my Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik used to say that that Gemara is a pellet, because if the child is holding on to an object that's stolen, so then when he becomes a gadol and he's sued in Bezdin, he has to return the object because he's holding on to someone else's property. But in the case of a mazik, he has to pay damages because of the action that he perpetrated. Well, we don't hold a katan responsible for his actions. If, let's say, a katan, even if he's a ben tes, and therefore he's capable of bia halachically, if he would have an illicit relationship, we cannot punish him when he becomes a bar mitzvah for an illicit relationship that he perpetrated when he was a katan. We don't hold a katan responsible for his actions. That's why it's very tricky to be a katan. Anyway, Alan, what were you saying?
The only thing I was wondering about it. It says Mishalim here. We're really talking about Lahashi, probably.
Ah, I see. The word Mishalim bothers you. Okay, very good. I don't know. Maybe what the Gemara wants to indicate here by using the word Mishalim is that there are two types of Tashlumin. In other words, the Chiyuv Damim, if the object is lost or destroyed, is a Chiyuv Tashlumin. Even if the Chiyuv is intact, if the object is intact, that object becomes a medium to pay its value. Now, why that should be so, I do not know. But I want to show you something in the last part of this Braisa. This I find fascinating. The Braisa says the following: V'im amru gedolim ein anu yodim cheshbonos shechishev avinu imcha pturim. We just finished saying that if the Yoresh, the child who's now mature, he's a gadol, is holding on to the item that was stolen, he has to return it. Now the Braisa seems to add a qualifying note. And in a case where the son, even though he's a gadol, let me put it to you this way, even if the son, the Yoresh, is a gadol, there's still is going to be a circumstance in which he doesn't have to return the stolen object. And this has nothing to do with Yeush. It just has to do with what we call a Tainas Baldin, which means that there could be a claim on the part of the Gadol that would exempt him from payment. Okay, now what is that claim? And what could that claim possibly be? That's what the sugya is going to try to dissect now. Because again, ostensibly at the face of it, it makes no sense that the child, who in this case a gadol, the yoresh, is holding on to a stolen object, and he has a taina, excuse me, and as a result of that taina, he becomes potter. That's what the Gemara is going to try to understand. Now, the literal translation of the Taina is the following: Ein anu yodim cheshbonos shechishev avinu imcha. We are unaware of all the calculations that our late father calculated with you. Says the Gemara, Mishum di Amri, because they claim Ein anu yodim, therefore pturim. It doesn't make any sense. Just because they claim we don't know, therefore they become potur. Now, what this means is that in Nezikin, when a person says Ein Anu Yodim or Ein Ani Yodea, that's called a Tainas Shema. Normally, a Tainas Shema is a very weak Taina, and it certainly falls short of a Tainas Bari when I can claim with certainty that you owe me money or you don't, or I don't owe you any money. Here, paradoxically, the Gemara is saying that because they say Ein Anu Yodim, because they're offering and presenting a Tainas Shema, therefore they become exempt. On the contrary, we have a rule, Bari V'Shema, Bari Adif. Now, where is this rule coming from? Bari V'Shema, Bari Adif. Rashi quotes it here, Dibra Maskel Mishum. And at the face of it, that question is a subject of a tremendous controversy. Bari v'shema bari adif, o bari v'shema lav bari adif. Rashi seems to assume, or at least within the context of this brisa, that bari v'shema bari adif. And that's something that is a little bit of a problem, because it would seem that we paskin bari v'shema lav bari adif. Now, what's the word after adif? Does anybody remember? Lav bari adif. Boo-boo. Nobody knows? Lahotzi. What does it mean, lahotzi? We have a halacha called chezkas mama. Michael and I learned about this morning. And in order to be motzi something from a muchzak b'mamon, you need what's called al pishnayim edim yakum davar. You need the highest realm, the level of evidence, which is testimony. This guy is coming up with a taina, and he has no support or evidence to support his claim. So what does it mean, bari v'shema bari ad? Very difficult to understand this. And the Pnei Yeshua is famous for saying that since the nitba, who's holding on to the money, right? He's the defendant in this case. He is claiming Shema, meaning maybe I do owe you money. Therefore, his chazaka becomes weak. Because if I possess this and I claim it's mine, that's one story. But if I possess this and I say I'm not sure if it's mine or yours, then what good is my possession? So, bari v'shema, bari adif. We paskin that bari v'shema lav bari adif, which means that a tainis bari cannot be motzi mamon miches kasa without the support of two edim. So here it's very strange. The Gemara's premise in the question is that if the son doesn't know whether he has to return this object or not, you know, he knows his father died and he inherited in the estate. He's not sure whether it belongs to him and it belonged to his father legally, or maybe his father stole it, as this guy is claiming. So the Gemara says that there's no reason why he should be potter, because his taina is a taina shema. He doesn't know. But perhaps the answer is as follows. And again, we're going to have to get into this, but everything I'm telling you now is according to one possibility. We're going to have two possibilities, but just get the first possibility, which is a little simpler. Nobody denies, and there's clear-cut evidence, that the object was stolen. The issue at hand was the nigzal ever reimbursed for the object? And that's where we have a bari v'shema situation. When does bari v'shema lav bari adif? That's the case of eino yodea im hilvisani, which means that I don't know if I ever borrowed money from you. I have no recollection. But there's another case which is called eino yodea im praticha. I don't know if I paid you back. This happens to me every muntik and darnishtik. I don't remember, did I pay him back or did I didn't pay him back? That's why the halacha is that you have to write a shtar, an IOU note, at least a ksav yodah. Be that as it may, in this case the Gemara establishes that even if bari v'shema lav bari adif, here bari is adif. And why is that so? Because there's something called a chezkas chiyuv. In other words, normally possession is the main chazok, but there's another kind of chazok, and that's called a chezkas chiyuv. What's a chezkas chiyuv? When nobody doubts and nobody denies that there was a chov, there was a debt, I lent you 1,000. The question is, did you remove that debt by paying me back? That's called Eino Yodeim Praticha. That's called a Shema against the Cheskas Chiyuv. And the Gemara establishes that if there's a Shema against the Cheskas Chiyuv, everybody agrees that the Toveh has a right to collect the money, because he has a Cheskas Chiyuv in his back pocket. And with that Cheskas Chiyuv, together with the Taina Shema of the defendant, the Nitba, he can be motzi mamon miches kaso, even if in general I hold bari v'shema lav bari adif. Here will be bari v'shema bari adif. Therefore, if we come back to our case, if the nigzal can establish with absolute certainty that the father of this heir had stolen an object from him, this particular object, he has witnesses to testify to that effect, then it creates what's called a chezkas chiyuv. And then the burden of proof is on anyone who says, well, I paid you back. And until you can establish that, is bari v'shema bari adif. And this is bari v'shema bari adif according to everyone. Why? Because we've engendered a chezkas chiyuv. Now again, I'm making a tremendous assumption here, and that is that the Nigzal has two Edim to testify on the Gzela. But if you grant me that assumption, soon we're going to see an alternative to that assumption. But at this point, just to make life easy for ourselves, since there's a Cheskas Chiv, we know that the object was stolen. Therefore, if this child, who's now a gadol, comes forward with a claim, Eini yodea, I don't know any of the business dealings of my father. Did he pay you back? Did he not pay you back? I can't tell. In such a case, the Gemara assumes he should be chayv. Why does the Braisa say he's potur?
Could I interrupt
you? Yeah, please.
I just need your phone call. And what's a good time to speak? By the way, Dr. Tarrigan.
Oh, nice to see you. How are you? You hail from Baltimore way back when?
No, I live in Schleimann.
No, I'm saying back when, yeah, like 50 years ago. Yeah, okay, yeah. Good. So I just wanted to identify you. Tarrigan in Baltimore is like...
Congrats for Moshe, my son.
Oh, shoot. He's the Gadol Ador.
I wouldn't
3-4-4-1-4-0, okay?
And next to his father he is. But
yeah, okay, good.
What's a good time to meet you?
Well, let's see, we daven Minchi at 1:30. If you can call me, let's say, at 2 or any time after that.
Okay. Sorry to be my friend.
Okay, no, not at all. Okay, good.
I was waiting a little longer.
Sometimes I'm so involved in the Shia that I don't even remember my own telephone number.
Waiting a little longer. Yeah. But it was a Shema that you would stop and divide that and keep going.
Okay, very good. Bari Shema. Fine. So now the Gemara says, "Omar Rava Hachi Kamar." Let's see if we could piece together this brisa and figure out why the son, the heir, who's a gadol, is now potter. And the answer is, says the Gemara, "Omar Rava Hachi Kamar." This is what the brisa has in mind: "Gdolim Sha'amru Yodim Anu Cheshbonos Shechishev Avinu Imcha." Velo posh loch gabe velo midi. What this gadol, this son, is claiming is yodim anu. Again, the mafarshim are going to have a whole party here how to fit this into the language of the brisa, but leaving out the linguistic challenge for a moment, we know exactly all the calculations and all the debts, outstanding debts of our father. And therefore, velo pashlach gabe velo midi, you have no debt to collect from us at all. Because we know that our father returned the money to you, pturim. Meaning that in this case, against the cheskas chiyuv that was established by the edim that support the claim of the nigzal, they have a taina of paraticha. We paid you back, meaning we know with the tainus bari that you've already been compensated for your gzela. And in that case, it's not bari v'shema, where we said against the cheskas chiyuv any of them praticha bari adif l'kuli alma, right? But rather it's bari u'bari. And if it's bari u'bari, then even against the cheskas chiyuv, we apply the principle of hamotzi mechavel v'ra'i, meaning that if I say to you, I paid you back, and I'm absolutely certain that I paid you back, in such a case, you cannot collect the debt from me and force me to pay you because I votes mechavev araya. Now, if you have a shtar, that's one thing. But again, in the case of Gzela, the fact that the Edom testify that Shimon stole from Reuven, that doesn't necessarily mean that Reuven has money to be collected from the son of Shimon. Because maybe, at some point in his life, Shimon the Goslin paid back Reuven. And every debt and all the debts were canceled out. That's exactly what the son is claiming. Now, alternatively, says the Rashi, there's another possibility. And that is that what the Gemara has in mind is that the Nigzal does not have witnesses to establish the Gzela. So there's no Cheskas Chiyuv. And in this case, it's very fascinating, when the son, the Gadol, responds with a claim that my father paid you back, then what we have is the nemanus of a migu. So let me explain what's going on here in the migu, if you could hold cup for this. Again, until now we've been talking about a case where the claim of the son is paraticha. Now, I didn't pay you back, but my father told me that he paid up all debts, including yours. That's cool.
Did he say that? Did he say including yours?
Yes, yeah, including yours, because otherwise it's not a tainas bari. The whole catch here to answer the Gemara's question is that we reinterpret the einanu yodim to make it into yodim, meaning that we negate the premise, which was the simple reading of the braisa, that he had, that the son had a tainas shema, and instead we substitute with a tainas bari. We know that this debt was paid up. Now we're investigating another possible claim on the part of the gadol, of the son, which would likewise lead us to the same end goal, end zone, namely that the son would be potter. And how is that? If lu yitzuyer, the nigzal has no witnesses to testify to the fact that the father, let's call him Shimon, had stolen this object, then what claim could the son have put forward? Ladam, exactly. He could have denied the whole story. What are you talking about? A guy off the street says that my father stole his cow? I don't believe it for a minute. And in that case, we would throw the case out of court immediately, because the Tovea, in this case the Nigzal, so to speak, in inverted commas, has no leg to stand on. He has no evidence to establish that there was a Gzela to begin with. Oh, if that be the case, then the son is believed to say that my father paid you up based on migu. That's an even more powerful nemanus, because now the son has in his back pocket, so to speak, the possibility of a winning claim of lo hayu dvarim me'olam. And in such a case, he's believed to say that it was paid up. This is the classical case of shtar mezuyif. What do I mean by shtar mezuyif? The malve comes to the love, and he's holding on to a shtar, but the shtar has no authenticity to it, meaning we were never able to authenticate the shtar. What's that called? To authenticate a shtar?
Kiyum
shtar. So we weren't able to mekayim the shtar. So the malve is holding on to the shtar, and the shtar is einam akuyum. At this point, the love has a right to say, lo hayud varm yola. And instead, he says, I paid you back. So, in effect, okay, this is a machlokus where the mode of shtar shiksov with tzorach l'kaimo ain't tzorach l'kaimo. But let's say, according to Mani Omar, tzorach l'kaimo, what he's saying is the following, that when the lova admits that there was a chov, and he validates the shtar, he's believed to say, I paid you up. Even though a lova is never believed to say, I paid up the malva, if the malva is holding on to a shtar, the exception to the rule is when the lova has a migu, because since the shtar has no kiyum to it, he, the lova, could have claimed, lo hayu dvar me'olam. The ganze meisa is gebluft. There never was alpha. It never took place. The shtar that you're holding on to is worth nothing. It's a piece of empty paper. It's a balloon without air in it. Why? Because it's a ziyuf. That's the claim that he has in his back pocket. That's called la'adam. Therefore, he's believed to say that which he normally would not be believed to say against the shtar, that he paid back the chov. Here too, if the nigzal has no edim to establish that this object was in fact stolen from him by the father, then the son has a right to tell him, go fly a kite, lo hayu dvarim me'olam, you have no leg to stand on, there was no gzela. If the son admits that this was stolen, or there was a theft, but my father squared it out with you, he paid up all his chovos, then although normally he would not be believed against the cheskas chiyuv, but nevertheless here he's believed because he has a migu.
Why would you believe the lover if he said he paid him back, if the malva has still got the shtar? When you pay somebody back, you make sure you take that shtar.
Right.
So why does he believe?
Right, but keep in mind, the shtar itself is a shtar sheinu makuyim. So the question is, whether or not shtar chabiyodi my boy, which means why didn't you take back the shtar, whether that applies to a shtar sheinu makuyim. I'll give you the short end of it so we can make a little more progress today. When the Chachamim required kiyum, we have to know that the Torah itself relied on the shtar because of Reish Lakish's famous principle of Eidim Achsum Al Shtar Havi Kamisha Nechkra Yidusim Bebes. And the Torah recognizes the shtar as being invincible. And no claim, even a claim of Ziyuf, that it's a forgery, will puncture even the slightest hole in the power and the authority of the shtar. But the Chacham made a takana called Kiyum Shtaris. And at that point, we don't know exactly what happened. One of two possibilities. And this is a fundamental issue that rips through all of Shas. Is it A or B? Did the Chachamim say the shtar is not worth the paper it's on? We assume that it's mezuyav until it's guilty until proven innocent, or no? The Rabbanim basically said the Torah is right. We're not going to undermine the Torah. The shtar is valid, but we have a problem with the shtar. And that problem with the shtar is that the kenechkara of Reish Lakish no longer applies to the shtar. And the nafkamina is going to be when the lover comes along and he says, yes, there was a halva, and in effect he's validating the shtar, but I paid you up. In such a case, if we go as far as to say that the Rabbanon stripped a shtar of its status as a shtar, and the kenechkara is completely undermined and neutralized, then migu makes sense. And all the kashas that we have against the migu are completely null and void, because the biggest kasha we have, as Michael said, against the migu is, why is he holding on to the shtar? The answer is, it's not a shtar. The Rabbanon were mafkia the chaloshev shtar. Okay, again, this is... okay, fine. Let's go on if we can. Birshuschem. Okay. Tanya Idoch. We have another braisa. Again, there's a long footnote here about a Baal Amor. I have a tremendous desire, but I'd be suicidal. I wouldn't be able to finish this year. So if anybody wants to hear about this Baal Amor, then we'll get to it another time. Okay. Tanya Idach, we have another braisa. Hagozel umachil es bonov pturim milashalim. As we said before, if the chefetz hagozel was consumed, and then instead of a chiyuv hashavas habe'en, we have a chiyuv hashavas domim, that cannot be imposed upon the yorshim, because they were not guilty of theft. Hiniach lifneim v'acholum. Now what happens, this is an issue that I touched on when we first started this perek, which is called hannah. What do I mean by hannah? In the laws of Nezikin, we really bifurcate into two fundamentally different roads, so to speak. One is guilt, which means that a person is liable for damages because of his negligence or his outright destruction of an object or stealing an object, etc., etc. And then we have what's called a chiyuv hanah. Okay, so we'll try to explain that the chiyuv hanah is monies that have to be paid even if there was no element of negligence or guilt whatsoever. And that's the subject of our sugya. We'll explain it as we go along. So he niach lifneim. In this case, the father died, and he left a piece of an edible food, which fell in front of the yarshim. V'acholum, and the yarshim, unbeknown to them, because they had no clue that this was a stolen watermelon, they went ahead and they ate it. Okay, so the Brisa says the following: Bein Gedolim, Bein Ktanim, Chayovim Lishalim. Now this is very strange, because we've just established that if the object that was stolen is destroyed, and we translate the Chiyuv Hashoveh into Chiyuv Tashlumei Domim, that doesn't apply to the Yarshim. And here the Brisa seems to be saying just the opposite, that both Gedolim and Ktanim have to pay. So the Gemara right away asks, Ktanim mi mechayve? You know, you may want to say that the Gedolim, again, might be chayev, because they ate it. Okay, we'll have to see. We'll get back to that in just a minute. But at least in the case of the Ktanim, how could we mechayev the Ktanim? The Gemara says, Lo yehei ela de azik azuke. Even if you want to consider it as if the ketanim are chayev here to compensate the nigzal, not betoris gazlan, but betoris mazik, because obviously if I consume your item, your foodstuff in this case, I have to pay you for damages, but not in the case of a katan. A katan is not subject to any sort of lawsuit or prosecution to pay for damages. So how could it be that the katan is held liable to pay for the food, the stolen food that was eaten. And Rashi adds here that we learned in the Mishnah Daf on Pei Zayin, the Chayr Shot V'Kodin Pegiyosan Ra, that if they are Chovel and they destroy someone's object, Pturim, they don't have to pay. Omar Rav Papa Hachi Komar, this is what the Brice has in mind. He Niach Lifnehem Vadayin Lo Acholum. The case of this Brice is not the way we understood it, straightforward, but rather the object that was stolen is still intact. And therefore, the object has to be returned Bein Gdolim, Bein Ktanim. Now this is a little bit of a problem for us, because we understood from the previous brisa that even in a case where the stolen object is Be'en, we still cannot sue the Katan for damages. So this is what we're going to have to analyze here. So let me just mention to you a few of the notes here on the bottom. Number one, Rashi is going to tell us that this brisa is authored by Sumchus. Now, this is not the famous Sumchus that we talked about this morning in the Daf Yomi Shir, but this is the Sumchus who says that in the case of Gzela, you do have recourse to go to Beis Din and force the Ketanim to cough up the object if it's still intact. So again, that's going to come up in just a few minutes, this machlokus between Sumchus and the Chacham. So until now, we learned a brisa that represents, and it reflects the sheet of the Chachamim of Sumchus, that a katan is completely exonerated from any sort of payment, even to return a chefetz hagozel that's bien. But this brisa that we're learning now reflects the sheet of Sumchus, that in the case of Gzela, the object has to be returned to its owner, even if it's now being possessed by a katan. That's point number one. Now, another point that I want to make here is that it says in the Braisa that Ella the Azik Azuke, that even if this child is guilty of Hezek, because the child implemented an act of Hezek, nevertheless, the child is not considered liable to pay for damages. So again, if the object is still intact, and that's going to be Rav Papa, then Sumchus will say that you can collect and force the katan to cough up that object, return it to its owner. If the object is gone, then whether or not it's gzela, or even if it's mazik, the child is potter. And if I wanted to read to you this footnote here, in the name of the Achronim, he says that the Gemara tells us in Bava Kamma that Raphram forced Rav Ashi to pay up for damages that he had implemented an act of Hezek to pay up when he became a Gadol. Is Katan Shehizik Chayev L'Shalem Kishi Yagdil? And the Achronim therefore want to understand why is it that the Gemara here doesn't mention that fact. You know, the language of the Braisa, in the way Rav Papa explains it, is that Ketanim would be potter if they already had eaten it, right? That's what Gemara says over Ketanim imachayve. You know, you get the impression that the Ketanim are completely exonerated off the hook, which is not really the case. If you're more meticulous about it, then the Ketanim are chayv to pay, just that we can't sue them right now, but they'll have to pay later on. And basically, the Achronim leave this as an unanswered question, because it would seem that this sugya would support the opinion that a katan is not capable of a maisa hezek. In other words, if a katan destroys property, what are we saying over here? Are we saying that we cannot sue him in a court because ein me'idim keneged katan, you can't testify against the katan? Or are we saying that it's much more fundamental than just a blockage, a barrier, that we cannot sue him in a court of language, but rather he's not capable of what is halachically considered a maisa hezek? And the nafka mina is, if you go with the first way, we'll wait till he's a gadol, then we'll sue him for damages. If you go with the second approach, then he'll never be chayev. And this touches on the following question. Rabbeinu Yonah, at the beginning of Masechta Avos, I don't know if any of you are learning Avos now, that's the minute. So Rabbeinu Yonah, in his first comment on Masechta Avos, says that a mazik is called a gazla. Now, nobody understands this, Rabbeinu Yonah. It makes no sense. But let's just grant it as a gzeiros hakosav. Rabbeinu Yonah equates a mazik with a gazla, meaning, what's gzeila? Gzeila doesn't mean that I took it from you, but, excuse me, gzeila doesn't mean that I have what's yours, but rather gzeila means that I took it away from you. Even if I don't have it, but as long as you don't have it, that's called gzeila. If that be the case, and this I saw in a sefer called Dvar Moshe, from Rav Moshe Rosemary, not if everyone's familiar with it, he says that based on Rabbeinu Yonah, you might conclude that the reason why a mazik has to pay damages is because he violated this iser of lo sigzal, according to Rabbeinu Yonah. And that's why he's responsible for damages. The other way of explaining it is that a mazik is chayv to pay damages not because of any avera, irrelevant to the avera. In fact, adamu liolam, even bishogeg, even baones, so it's hard to say that he's guilty of an avera. But rather, he has to return the object or its value to compensate the nizak because of his level of responsibility. So it's not considered the laws of punishment. You know, we're not talking about an onesh, but rather we're talking about a monetary law of compensation.
Akin to borrowing.
Equivalent to borrowing. Now the truth is that, and the Rav used to say this always over the name of Reb Chaim, there's a clear-cut proof that a damager pays b'toras onshin. It's a punishment for the crime. So just mention it on the side and then we'll go on. There's a Mishnah that says in Bava Kama, Hamagdish, excuse me, Hasoref es gedisho shel chaver b'shavis potur. The Meiri says that Kimle ben Ravine only applies to two onshin. It doesn't apply to a chiv mamon. It's the fact that in the same action I incurred a chiv mamon and a punishment, that punishment doesn't knock off the chiv mamon. I owe you this mamon, and that's period, end of it. So how does the Mishnah say that if I burn down your haystack on Shabbos, I don't have to pay you damages? The answer is, based on Rabbeinu Yonah, we could say the damages are being paid because of the avera, the punishment for the crime of gzela. If you're willing to be open-minded and assume that damaging is called gzela, which is a stretch. Now the nafkamina to this whole discussion is a katan. A katan is not capable of an avera, which means that the Torah doesn't recognize the action of a katan as a criminal act. Now, I don't know, again, the other legal systems, I'm not sure how it works, but in Jewish law, a katan is not capable of a criminal act. He will never be punished for that which he did as a katan. So the nafkamina is going to be, if a katan was mazik, can we sue him for damages when he becomes a gadol? If the problem is that it's a technical issue, we cannot sue him for damages because he's a katan, now we can sue him for damages because he's a gadol. But if it's much more fundamental, and that means that the chiyuv of paying damages is a punishment for a crime, then he can be a gadol, he can be Moshe Rabbeinu, it doesn't matter, you can't hold him responsible and liable to pay damages for something that's not an avera at all, because a katan is not capable of a maisa avera. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger here said something which incurred the wrath of Reb Chaim. Reb Kivega was approximately a century before Reb Chaim. You'll check the history of it. I'm probably off by a good couple of decades. Well, let's say Reb Chaim died in 1925 or so. I don't know exactly. Reb Kivega probably died in 1850. I don't know. Again, roughly. So Reb Kivega wanted to say that a katan is capable of a maisa avera, just that we can't punish it. We don't have the wherewithal to punish a katan because punishment involves corporeal punishment, and that we can't do to a katan, even though he's capable of a maisa avera. Reb Chaim was very, skeptical about this premise, but I think the Reb Chaim himself changed his mind, because once Reb Chaim came up with the proof from Madlikas Gedisha Shel Chaver B'Shabbes Potter, that therefore it must mean that a katan excuse me, that paying for damages is a result of an avera and it has a din of an onesh, at that point, Reb Chaim had a problem. How then can Raphram force Rav Ashi to pay damages to the Nignav, to the Nizak, for a criminal act that he perpetrated when he was a katan? So the impression I get was from the Rav that at that point Reb Chaim rethought the whole sugya, and he too came to the conclusion that a katan is capable of a maisa avera. It has tremendous repercussions, both ethically and legally in halachic terms. And Reb Chaim proved this from the parsha of Shifcha Harufa. Have you ever heard of that parsha? Okay, the case is a man has bia, a Jewish man, with a chatzi, Shifcha chatzi meschorin. And the Torah says he has to bring a karmon to be mechaper for that avera, because the chetzi Shifcha Sheva makes him into a kadesha, the lav of kadeshus. And for that, the Torah says Yechayv a karbon asham. I think it's called Asham Shifcha Harufa. Is it included in the karbonos? Yeah, it's in Ezer Makom. Now the law is, get this, hold on to your seat, that a katan who's a ben tes, who's capable of bia, who has bia with a Shifcha Harufa, is Chayv a karbon. Now, a karbon, by definition, is a mechaper for an avera. How could a katan be chayv a karbon for an action that he perpetrated as a katan? Said Reb Chaim, you see from this that even a katan is capable of a maisa avera. Just normally he's exempt from punishments, that corporeal punishments. But as far as a karbon is concerned, he can bring a karbon. Again, there's a myriad of questions that have to be raised here on that premise. Omar Rav. Let's see. What happens if Reuven, during his lifetime, borrowed a cow? Now, what makes a borrower unique in terms of the constellation of Shomrim? What chiyuv is? Onus. He's chai for onus. No matter what happens, lightning can strike and kill the cow. The shoel has to pay damages. But in this case, what happened? The Shoel, we'll call him Reuven, died. And now Chanoch ben Reuven has inherited his father. So what does he inherit? He inherits a borrowed cow. So the law, this is the easy part of it, says Rava, Mishtamshin ba kol yimei she'elasa. Let's say the agreement was that Reuven could borrow this cow for, let's say, 6 months. He died after 3 months. So now, Chanoch is allowed to use the cow for 3 months, the balance. Mesa, now the cow dies. Now, certainly, if Reuven were alive, he'd have to pay the mashil for the cow. Ein chayavin beyond seah. This makes no sense. The Brisa, I'm sorry, Rava's statement is that in this case, the children, the heirs, do not have to pay for onsen. And what's going on here? They should be paying for onsen because they have a din of a shoel. Oh. So there are two dinim in a shoel, apparently. One din of a shoel is that he has rights to use the object. The other din of the shoel is that he's responsible for onsen. And Rav wants to split between those two dinim. You can have a person who, on the one hand, is allowed to use the object, but on the other hand, he's not chayv onsen. Hayitochein, how could it be? And the answer is that in order for shoel to be chayv onsen, we have to add one proviso, and that is what? No, that's more sophisticated. I'm just on a basic level. We need what's called kabolas achrayus, which means that if I come to you and I say, lend me your cow, then that is considered, according to the halacha, as if I was makabel achrayus, and that makes me into a shoel who's chayav even for onsen. Oh, now the nafkamina between these two dimensions is going to be the case of Yoresh. He never accepted upon himself any chayav shmira. The owner of the cow, the mafkid, is obligated vis-a-vis both the father and, in this case, the son, to allow the use of his cow for up to 6 months. And therefore, the heir Yoresh, he inherits his father's schus mamon to use the cow. But on the flip side, the negative side, namely the kabbalas achrayas for onsim, that he never took upon himself. Alan, remind me of this Rava when we get to Tzvei Dinim, you know, which we're going to get to in our 9 o'clock shiur. Okay. Now, Rava goes on to tell us something very interesting. Kisvurim shalaviyam hi. They had no clue that this cow was a borrowed cow. They assumed that it belonged to their father, and they inherited it. Tfachuhu v'yachlu. So they wanted to have a good barbecue, a family barbecue. So what they did was they shechted the cow, and everybody ate the meat of the cow. They had a real joyous party here. It was let's party, right? Now in this case, I would have said, if I didn't read the next line in Rava's statement, that they don't have to pay for that because this is like onus. Now, why is this like onus if they deliberately shechted the cow? And the answer is because they didn't know that it was a barred cow. So there's no level of responsibility here in any case. So b'toras mazik, he can't be machayev. Then b'toras shoel, they weren't makabel chiyuv v'shmira. So b'manav shach, they should be patur. Comes along Rav and he says, mishalmin to be basar b'zol. What this means is that there are two mechayvim, as I said a few minutes ago, in tashlume nezikin. One is pure nezikin, which means that someone was mazik, he's negligent or guilty of damaging someone, and therefore sure he has to pay damages. And now we have another halacha, and that's called hanah. Hanah means that if I benefit from your object, I have to pay you for that benefit. Even though you never allowed me to have that benefit, I didn't allow you to shecht my cow, but you shechted my cow. Now, how much would it be worth it to you to go out to the marketplace and buy a cow, shecht it, and eat its meat? So the Gemara calls that Demei Basar Bezol. There are two market prices that determine the value of any commodity. One is the going rate, and then there's something called bizol. The minimum, correct. And the minimum is considered 2/3 of the going rate. So if these children who inherited this cow knew, that's not our case, but had they known that this was a barred cow, they would have to pay the full price of the cow, 100. But since they were unaware of the fact that this was a barred cow, therefore there's no chiyuv b'taras nezikin, says Rava, nevertheless, we have a chiyuv b'taras hanah. And when there's a chiyuv b'taras hanah, they'll pay 66. How much is it?
2/3.
And 2/3.
Okay. 66 and 2/3? That didn't change since my youth? Okay. Because everything that I learned in math has changed since my time. Okay.
Not this.
Okay, that last line is going to occupy our minds for today and probably at least one more session that we can get together, Mr. Shem, on Yom Chamishi, correct? What's going on over here? It's a funny case, and it really boggles the mind to think about this. And I push it loose sleep at night trying to figure this out. Maybe you'll help me with this. The father accepted upon himself achrayus as a shoel, which means he's chayv for onsim. Now he's got a piece of real estate. Even if the children, the heirs after his death, do not have to pay for his father's debts, but if there's an inherited lien on the property of the estate, the karka that they inherited, that can be collected by the Baal Chov regardless of the children. They're not even relevant to this case. We just cut them all out. You know, I own a shibud on your karka, your father's karka. I'm going to collect it in lieu of the debt. That's called gvia mimishubadim. But here, the case is very, very confusing. It tickles the brain. Is this really a shibud? Again, there was karka in the possession of the father, and certainly the children inherited that karka, but was there a lien on the karka? The father was a shoel on a para. In event that the para dies, Nebuch, the mashil will have recourse to collect the value of the para from the shoel, from the father. But the father's not alive. Not only that, when did the para leave this world. It was after the father's death. Now the question is, do I have some sort of retroactive shibud over here? Meaning, assuming that the chiv to pay as a lover has a chiv to pay a malver is engendered at the moment that this animal dies, do we have some sort of retroactive shibud as if to say the Yarshim inherited a land, a piece of real estate that had a lien on it during the lifetime of the father? Well, I don't know. One side of me says absolutely not. How can there be a lien when the para is well fed and alive on all four at the time of the death of the father? The other side of me says, well, wait a minute. The father was Makabel Achrayus. Since he accepted the Sheila, he's Achrayi, he's responsible even for Onsim. At that point in time, the Shibud is. Now, whether or not the cow will die, that's totally in destiny, but it's irrelevant. When the cow dies, the chiyuv really goes back to the moment of she'ela. In Yiddish, we would say, das licht in dem she'ela. It's inherent in the she'ela itself. The very moment I borrow it, inherent in that Kabbalah Sachrayus is a shibud of my nechassim to pay you in event that the animal is lost. In other words, can we talk about she'ela as some sort of conditional chiyuv, or do we say no, that chiyuv doesn't exist? That chiyuv only emerges with the destiny of the cow, with the destruction of the object that was borrowed. A fascinating question, no? So I think that's what the Gemara is analyzing now. The Gemara says the following. There are two ways of interpreting this last line. The first interpretation is that it goes back to the Reisha. In the Reisha, there was a Chiyuv Onsim. If the onus took place, the Bailim have right to collect from the father, if the father were alive. Now, at this moment, correction. At the moment in which the father borrowed this cow, all his nechasim become mishubadim to pay for onus in the event that there is an onus. And therefore, when we go back to the Reisha, and the Reisha says that hiniach lehem avim parashu'ula is mishtamshim ba kol yemei she'elasa, and therefore ein chayovim ba'on seha, on that Rava adds a stipulation, which only appears at the end of the Sefer, namely, that if hiniach lehem avim achrayus, meaning when is it that the Yarshim are einom chayovim ba'on sim, that's when they inherited metaltalim, but they didn't inherit karka. But if they inherited karka, then they do have to pay up. Again, as I said before, we can cut them out. We don't have to demand payment. The malva in this case, or we'll call it the mashiel, just comes and collects. He confiscates the karka. He's got shivud. But ikar de masli asefa, there are those who want to say no. This last clause relates to the seifa, and in the seifa it says that if the yarshim. So again, what do we say? It means that the mashil has recourse to collect from mishubadim, right? That's what says iniach lema avim achrayis chayovim. Ika demasli le'asefa. There are those who say that this last line in Rava goes back to the last case, the seifa, which means that what? That if the yarshim were unaware of the fact that this paro was indeed borrowed by their father, correct? Then in such a case, the mashiel has the right to what? To only collect the dmei basar bazal. Comes along Rav and he says the following, that's not true. That's only true if there was no shibud. But if there was a shibud, then instead of collecting from the Yarshim 2/3, they can collect 100%. So now why is this so? Again, in the Ika Damasli Asefa, all of a sudden as a result of the shibud, the mashil could collect the full price. Oh, so comes along the Rashbam and this is also based on the Rosh and Tosus elsewhere, and they want to suggest that the reason why in this case, since there was a Sheba, the Balaam have a right to collect the entire value of the Basar, is because the father himself was guilty of negligence. Now, where's the negligence over here? The answer is, Havile lohodia lohem she'enu shalo. He should have notified his children. Again, it depends how he died, but assuming he was some sort of disease, he should have notified the children before his death that this para cannot be shechted, it has to be returned to its bialim, it says para she'ula. And for not doing so, he's chayav. Man demasna le'aresha, kol shken aresha. If you interpret that this Bryce is going on the Sefer, then certainly it goes on the Resha. Upligad Rav Papa. And it's against the statement of Rav Papa. Now, we haven't learned Rav Papa yet. That's going to be the subject, Bli Neder of Ashir, on Thursday. But Mandam Asli Le Asefer, Avala Resha, Lo Vahainu de Rav Papa. So if I interpret this last line in Rav's statement as a qualification of the Sefer, then it applies to the Sefer because there was some sort of shibud from the moment that the Baal, the father was poshea, and he didn't notify that child. That pshia itself engenders a shibud during his lifetime. So the shibud then was chal on the karka vis-a-vis the mashil during his lifetime. Avala reisha lo, but in the case of the reisha, where we don't have this assumption of pshia, then there is no recourse for the mashil to collect, because there was no shibud from the time of the she'ela. The shibud is engendered by the onus itself, and the onus itself took place after the death of the father. What time is it now?
1:14.
Okay, Rabbi, so let's just summarize in the last minute that we have. What we've seen here are two basic sugyas. One sugya we saw, and that is that there's a question about Bari Vashem in the case of Gdolim that inherited stolen property. Can they come forward and claim that we certainly know that our father paid you back? And if they do, they have a Tainas Bari. Would they be believed? It depends if there's a Cheskes Chiyuv. It depends if they're Edom to testify that the object was stolen. It depends whether they have a Migu. That was our first sugya. And the second sugya that we learned was about ketanim. What's the status of a katan vis-a-vis the laws of damages? It would seem that there's going to be a machlokas coming around the bend between sumchus and the rabbanon whether you collect from the katan if the gzela is still intact. If on the other hand they ate the gzela, you cannot be mechayv them b'toras nizikin. This seems to contradict the principle that we know in Rafram and Rav Ashi that you can force the katan to pay for damages when he becomes a gadol. It's only a technical temporary barrier. And finally, the sugya of Rava, of Yarshim that inherit a parasha ula, and do they have rights and responsibilities vis-a-vis that?
Have some fun with it, right?
Yeah.